Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
This podcast with our old friend from Smash Hits, Neil Tennant, turned out to be so involved and engaging that we're putting it out in two parts. So here, recorded in a slightly echoey but atmospheric room in London's Somerset House, is part one. Part two to follow shortly.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
Are you on? Are you recording?
I think we are, Mark, yes.
Hello, hello, hello.
1-2-1-2-2-2-2.
2-2?
2-2.
Yeah,
come on.
Fine. 1-1, isn't this a lot of fun? Or is that Spinal Tap?
How was it? Really?
I think so. Are you there?
Spinal Tap just reissued?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Well, welcome to another edition of Word in Your Ear. And David and I are sitting here looking at an old copy of Smash Hits from January 1983, Malcolm McLaren on the cover. And we have fallen through a wormhole in time.
We have.
Back to the office where Electric Avenue by Eddie Grant is probably playing. Too Shy by Kajagoogoo. You can hear the rattle of typewriters. The constant ringing of telephones. There is the scent of cigarette smoke and instant coffee. And next to us, as he is now, was the news editor of
Dr. Bits
of the Bits section. Neil Tennant. Neil, it's lovely to see you again.
Lovely to see you.
Fantastic. And yeah. What you would have been working on was the happy birthday section. Let me remind you that David Bowie was 36. Jimmy Page, 39.
We probably thought that was old.
We did.
Was Jimmy Page 39. Ever 39?
No, 39. Rod Stewart was 38. That seems ancient. Suggs, 22. Chaz Smash, 24. Jeremy Healy of Hazy Fantasy, 21.
Gosh.
Isn't that amazing?
Pop stars are young again, though, aren't they? Some of them are, anyway.
Are they? There's every generation nowadays, isn't
there? Yeah,
really?
There is.
So it's completely full. So we were just talking about, before we started recording, how our paths originally crossed. What's your version?
So I was working, I had worked for Madonna Educational Publishers. Before that, I worked for Marvel Comics. And then I left Marvel Comics, sorry, Madonna Educational was owned by the British Print Corporation. We were in a huge industrial dispute, and the company was bought by Robert Maxwell, and I was one of the local NUJ chapel heads. What was it called? Father of the chapel.
Yes.
And anyway, so Robert Maxwell, we got reinstated by Robert Maxwell, and I didn't want to work for Robert Maxwell, so I got offered a job at ITV Books doing TV tie-ins.
Yeah.
At which point I thought I should buy a TV, because I didn't have one. And this is why my knowledge of 70s television is still very poor. And then I decided we would do a sort of tie-in brochure book thing about Madness's film, Take It or Leave It. And to design it, I approached the editor of The Face, Steve Bush. The editor of The Face, the designer of The
Face.
Designer
of The Face, he was.
Steve Bush. Yeah. Remember, The Face was achingly cool when it first came out, and sort of more or less remained that for a while. And anyways, I met Steve Bush, at the offices of a magazine called Smash Hits, which I have to be honest, I wasn't aware of.
Really?
I wasn't aware of. And I thought, oh, it's this magazine with lyrics and things. And
so you came into the office then?
I came into the office.
Did you walk over? Did you meet us? Did Steve introduce you?
I don't remember.
Carnaby Street, this is.
I know when I did come in. Anyway, I'll come to that. And anyway, so we did. I got Adrian Thrills, the enemy, to do the interviews. I got my friend Eric Watson to take all the pictures of each member of Madness. Eric had been, I'd known for many, several years, and he'd been towards the art college and then sorry, photography. He worked with Red Saunders. And he learned, and so he was great at lighting. So he did the pictures. It was one of his first professional commissions. And I brought the pictures into Steve Bush. This is probably the first time. And it's for Steve Bush to look at, to put in, to do the layout with. And you said, these pictures are great. The music industry is going to eat him up. About Eric Watson.
Oh, right.
He did lots of covers for Smash Hits.
He did.
Transformed Smash Hits. He really did.
Well, of course, you'd only just started commissioning pictures.
Yeah, it's probably true.
Yeah.
Because when you took over as editor, you were still in the world of free.
You were just using 35mm.
What have you got?
LFI.
Yeah.
Eric is the first person probably to be regularly commissioned to shoot covers, I would have thought. You know, he had a very distinct style and it just suited Smash Hits.
So. And it helped to create the Smash Hits style.
Oh, definitely.
And then we did that, and then we did the Tis Was yearbook, which gave the editor of Smash Hits an idea.
Yes.
Of the
We're
Smash
now
Hits.
Looking at a copy of the 1984 Smash Hits yearbook. And I've got the 1983, both edited by Neil Tennant.
Anyway, I was glad you had that idea, because it meant one day to ITV. And then I did, you were asking me before we were recording about Betty Foster. We also did the ITV knitting book with Mary Parkinson, which Eric did all the pictures for.
Yeah.
This is Michael Boggs's missus.
She was on daytime television. She was on Thames, you know. And then we did the Betty Foster dressmaking system, which I never totally really understood, but it was a thing. And Eric did the pictures for the patterns. And anyway, then one day in the office, you phoned up, Dave Hepper phoned me up, and said, well, do I want to meet for lunch? And I thought, he's going to offer me a job. And he did offer me a job to do the Smash Hits yearbook. Then, famously, my first day, it was announced in passing that I was the news editor.
That was just thrown in,
was
it?
Just thrown in, because I was, you know, doing the yearbook. And
where did we meet for that lunch? Was that a place that used to be a cafe in Lexington Street that is now achingly trendy? I seem to remember negotiating with you over your opening salary, and you were going in very hard and ordering extra apple pie and custard, thinking.
And luncheon
vouchers.
I'm
going to get that. I was always
very good at lunch. Always very, very good at lunch. I still am, actually. It wasn't just the Bomber, was it?
No, it wasn't actually. It was Lexington Street.
The Bombonera.
Bombonera, Carnaby
Street. It wasn't La Perla.
It wasn't La Perla, which was
in Old
Compton Street.
Yeah,
where we used to go with our ad director.
La Perla was on Brewer Street or Berwick Street?
Berwick Street. Yeah, brilliant.
We used to go with our ad director, Rod Sopp, do you remember? And they said, how do you want your steak? And he would say, just break its horns off, wipe its arse, and slap it on the plate. And then when it came, he'd say, hang on a second. He said, do I hear lowing? Yeah. A good vet could get that back on his feet in 10 minutes.
So you'd never come across Smash Hits, but then going back.
But I knew the face. The face was very new then. But
it was new. And new. It seemed.
I was an AME
with kind of.
So what did you read? Yeah, because we were going to talk about the pop press. We all worked for it, and then you were eventually covered by it. So
well,
what did you read when you were
in a? Funny enough, in a second-hand bookshop in Morecambe on Bank Holiday Monday.
Oh, hi, well, we found each other.
We found each other, but I'd love a decaf black coffee.
Decaf black coffee.
Do you want anything along those lines?
Thanks. Thank you.
Thanks. I've just done Ryland. A bound volume of The Eagle comic. We used to read The Eagle, Swift for younger readers.
Yes.
And Girl for Girl, my sister.
Absolutely.
I read everything that came in the house, so we have comics like that. Susan used to get June and School Friend, which had one of my favourite comic strips of all time, The Four Marys.
The Four Marys
was in it. Then she graduated, of course, to Jackie.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe even still going. No?
Is it still going now?
No, probably not. Probably not. Then she moved up the food chain to Petticoat.
It is, yes.
Janet Street Porter's first editorial job, yes, which is a friend of mine. And then...
Bunty?
Rave. She never got Bunty. The Tennants were all very pop.
Yes. Right.
We were all very pop people. Susan was a huge... My sister was a huge fan of Paul Jones.
Yeah, yeah. Very rave.
Very rave.
Of the Manfreds.
Of the when he left the Manfreds.
When he left, yeah,
he was in Privilege.
Yeah.
We had the EP of Privilege.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Yeah. The early Paul Jones solo records, really good records.
No. Produced by Miley Ander, I think.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. And then very early on, because I was a huge Beatles fan, as I'm sure we all were, I started buying the NME in about 1965. Do you remember you used to have adverts on the front?
Yes. Now, was it, I was thinking about this today, was it still the New Musical Express at that point?
Or what?
It was. It didn't come in and eat a lot
and
later.
And is the transition of the New Musical Express to the NME...
Counterculture.
The only successful example of the rebranding of a music paper. Because people perfectly happily adopted it as the NME. Whereas the Melody Maker tried this for years, didn't they? MM.
The MM.
The Maker. Never took at all.
RM for the Record Mirror.
It just never took. Work. NME took.
I think it's because New Musical Express was A, a mouthful, and B, the Express bit.
Yes.
It's sort of slightly embarrassing. Something.
Well, everything about it. New musical sounds like a load of old fogies.
Yeah, it sounds like the West End Theatre or something.
Yeah, yeah. It, absolutely.
So NME, and of course, there's a radical shift in NME from the Keith Oldham thing of maybe, actually Penny Valentine, I don't think they did write them, of sort of showbiz gossip to counterculture.
Yeah.
I.e. Nick Kent, Charles Shaw Murray, Ian McDonald, etc.
Yeah, yeah.
And also teenagers walking around suburban cities in their army grey coats with long hair with Jethro Tull albums and stuff. They wanted to get a bit more serious, man. And NME, amazingly, went from really being super show business to being super counterculture and stayed there till the end of the 80s, even beginning of the 90s, they were still in with Manchester, etc.
Absolutely. Who was your favourite writer? Can you remember that in the NME? Who did you like?
Charles Shaw Murray. Charles Shaw Murray. I remember.
Can you remember any particular pieces?
Yes,
you wrote?
I can. In 1972, when Bowie reappeared, and he was on the Old Grey Whistle Test, and my brother and I, Simon and I, stayed up to watch it. And we both immediately thought, well, that's it. It's all about David Bowie now. And that was the end of the Incredible String Band.
Yes, up till then it was a string.
Then, so to my friend Christelle, well, that's the end of the Increds.
Yeah.
And it was Bowie. Anyway, he wrote a two-part piece in the NME called David at the Dorchester, where he's all, the RCA is spending an insane amount of money. Bowie's completely, Bowie's being gay. And Lou Reed comes in and he kisses him, you know. But it's a good, very good piece by Charles Shaw Murray. So good, it carries on the next week.
This is it.
And Simon, actually, we shared a bedroom. Simon had this pinned up on the bedroom wall, along with many other cuttings by David Bowie. And so my first job when I left college was London editor of Marvel Comics, which is a production editor job. But we had an art exhibition at when I first started at the ICA. And so, and I did PR for Stan Lee. Stan Lee came over because he had a book out about how they made comics. And so I invited people. I invited Mark Bolan, and I invited...
And you interviewed Mark Bolan?
I've interviewed Mark Bolan.
That's tell us about that. That's fantastic.
I decided to do a series of people, pop fans, who liked Marvel Comics simply because I wanted to be a music writer. And I thought, well, these are my magazines. I'll do what I want with them. And so I interviewed Mark Bolan in I think, 1976. Maybe 75 or 76, I can't remember. He was fat. He was still in the fat phase.
He was just about to have the TV programme.
He was just about to have my... Yeah. He was actually, as we would say at Smash Hits, down the dumper.
He was down the dumper.
But he was sweet.
And the buttons
you know,
on the satin shirt were had, stretched a bit.
And he had an album out called Futuristic Dragon.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Bit comic, bit Silver Surfer-y. So he generously did the interview. He was really, really sweet. It's a famous thing that I borrowed from one of the designers. We had two designers who worked in the office. I borrowed a cassette player and it was pouring down when I got there, Keith Oldham's office, And I put it on the table, and then we crossed the room and sat down on the sofa. And I was, for some reason, I thought it was just too uncool to take the cassette recorder with us. And Mark Bolan thought he's obviously an idiot or something. So he just walked across the room, got the tape recorder, and put it down between us, which was very, very gracious.
And then repeated everything he just said, probably.
It was very... And I've still got the tape somewhere. And he was, it was so great. He had big fat fingers like sausages. He wasn't at all delicate,
yeah,
like the image.
Yeah.
And he talked about Marvel Comics and like the Silver Surfer and Conan the Barbarian and stuff. And then I was asking about if they've ever written songs of David Bowie. He asked about the Grumpy String Band. He said, because he liked those heads. He called them heads, I think. And it was great. And then I did one with Alex Harvey, where we were taken by the record company, me and a friend, down to watch him in Coventry and interviewed him backstage. And then the series fizzled out.
It was a two-part series.
Paul McCartney wouldn't do it, and neither would the Bay City Rollers.
Oh, no.
So that was that.
No. Going back to your Bowie feature, Charlie Murray, whatever, it is amazing how...
So actually, Charles Charles Murray came to that, right. that comic thing we had. Yeah.
Right. But you still probably quote bits of that thing.
I just remember the headline, Dave at the Dorchester. I remember him kisses Lou Reed. But Iggy Pop's probably around as well, isn't he?
Part that those things played in our lives when we were kind of teenagers.
Well,
because if the enemy didn't arrive or whatever, you happened to read, and it was on strike or whatever, the sun would just go in.
The rhythm of your life was thrown by that completely.
Oh, in London, unlike the provinces, in London you could get on Wednesday afternoon.
Yeah.
Do you remember you used to go to
Oxford,
the newsagent?
Go to Oxford, yeah.
Next to the London Palladium as well, that one.
Okay, that one.
Still there. And so you'd have it on Wednesday as well, Newcastle as well, Thursday morning. And
you used to build clothes pegs on a little, on a string.
That's right, yeah. It was a highlight of the week. And what's astonishing, though, is the impact and importance of written stuff, content, to one's musical tastes.
Yeah.
So you read Nick Kent's review of Television's first album, Marquee Moon.
Yeah.
Well, you've got to go out and get it.
Yeah.
There's literally no option.
Well, how many thousands of people did that? I mean, it was just a...
It wasn't even out when you wrote the review.
Was it?
It was import.
It was American import.
It was on import for like 6 weeks before they got out.
I used to phone up the New York office of Marvel Comics. I remember Bob Dylan brought out single only, double ace, double side. What's the first track from Desire? Hurricane, part one and two.
All right.
And they sent me it over in the bag with all the comic stuff. And of course, it didn't have a middle. American singles didn't have a middle. It was frightful. That was frightfully exciting. One's musical taste was completely defined, really.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
What kind of things were you turned on to by people at the NME?
I'd say, like television, punk rock, you know, I liked. I would buy the Clash's albums, for instance.
Punk rock was perfect. Did you go to a Sex Pistols gig very early on?
Yes, I went. Eric Watson, with his art school friends, had seen the Sex Pistols, and so I went with him to see them at the Nashville in West Kensington.
Yes.
And
you wrote something.
And I wrote something. And Sid Vicious, who wasn't in the band then, of course, Sid Vicious famously beat up Nick Kent with the bicycle chain. This was a horrible incident, although you could mythologize.
Was that
it
at
now.
The Nashville?
That was at the Nashville.
Oh, right.
And there's blood, you know, and we left. And I didn't go to a concert for about 3 years after that because I was because it was
dangerous.
There was an atmosphere of violence. And it was coming from Newcastle. When I, in Newcastle, it was full of skinheads who were trying to beat you up, you know, and it was, and so I was wary about going out at night, and that reinforced it for a while, and that's what got over it.
So what did you write, and where did that appear?
So I wrote a letter to the NME, very much in NME speak, if you were to see, it's actually printed in, that's a book called The Sex Pistols File, I think still in print.
Wow.
It's on like page 3, and they say, reader, Neil Tennant of London SWR. I was living in a bedsit in Knightsbridge at the time, and they printed my thing saying, you know, what had happened and also how it probably worked for Sex Pistols, obviously trying to become notorious. And Joe Smith, their photographer, happened to be there and he had pictures. So it was quite.
So did it happen quite near you? Did you see it?
Yeah, I got the bus from Knightsbridge.
No, but Sid's attack on
them. Yeah, no, it was, you know, 40 yards away. Yeah.
Christ.
No, it was scary. It wasn't very nice. It wasn't very nice at all. And anyway, I was thrilled to pieces that it printed in the
So your name appeared for the first time, wasn't it?
Reader Neil Tennant, London Esther.
And can you remember standing out in the street reading it?
Yes.
That's the whole truth. When you first see your name in print, you just read it again and again and again.
Oh, well,
and your eyes just missed over.
No. On Marvel Comics, on page 2, as you turn the cover over, at the bottom are tiny credits. And it said, London editor Neil Tennant. That was the first of us when I named print. And I was
You just want everybody in the world you've ever met to
was
see
your mother thrill?
Maybe she was. At least it was a job because she didn't like me going to Marvel Comics because it was obviously.
Because my mother used to go to the newsagent and just pick up a copy of Smash Hits and just make sure my name was still in there.
Oh, when I went to Smash Hits, aura of disapproval about going to this ridiculous children's music magazine, but it became a thing. We were famously on the television once on BBC Breakfast or something.
Twice,
crikey. And then. You know, she was quite proud of it. And then when I left to do the Pet Shop Boys, she was horrified.
My mother used to wear Smash Hits badges.
Did she?
She used to wear one saying Simple Minds, which she thought really suited her. And she would hope that people would ask her why she was wearing this badge. She would say,
oh,
because it's from a magazine called Smash Hits that's edited by my son. This is so touching. Those things matter.
But on that thing of Seagull Imprint, I remember going to the CBS building in Soho Square.
Yeah.
And getting a box of the first West End Girls, which is 40 years ago this month, April 1984, and going home on the bus to the King's Road, not the 90 bus, the King's Road, and really that was like the greatest moment of my life at that point.
Little box of 25.
Yeah, the 12-inch records, funny enough.
Oh right,
the big box. Actually, weirdly, I never got a 7-inch records, and I had like 25. Or something like that, 12-inch records. And that was just really... That was really the ambition fulfilled at that point. I really expected to go much further. But it was really, really, really... That was really, really exciting. And I think, you know, my parents were probably quite impressed by that.
Wasn't it the 80s an amazingly good time to be a writer, don't you think?
No.
Because it was so colourful.
Doors opened.
Interesting.
Pop stars were great.
Pop stars were great. There was so much success.
Without you,
pop stars
they
were
weren't
slagging
great.
Each other off. There was controversy. There was colour. Also, there would have been... I can't imagine another decade they would have allowed groups like Culture Club or, Yazoo or whatever to materialise. If you're Frankie Goes to Hollywood. It was an amazing decade, wasn't it?
No, it was amazing. I think although some people, although Noel Gallagher would disagree, I think it's the last great era of pop songwriting that is looking forward.
Right.
Maybe that goes, that lingers into the 90s with Suede or something. But then it becomes, suddenly it's about the Beatles. It's about the Stones. It's about the Who. It's about the Kinks in particular.
Right. Yeah.
Or it's sort of not quite pop music. It's something to do with hip-hop and stuff like that. Yeah. But that sort of continuum that really isn't the 50s, it starts with the Beatles, carries on till about, for 30 years, approximately 1993.
Yeah.
And it's an amazing, I mean, there's still, of course, loads of great pop songs written after that, but something extraordinary was always happening. And I think it's very rare for something extraordinary to happen in pop music now. I mean, if you think of the 60s, people always say to me, what's the best decade? And although they all think I'm going to say the 80s, I always say the 60s. Because in the 60s, an unbelievable record came out every week.
The like of which you'd never heard
before. And of course, we didn't really have any records. But it wasn't even Radio 1, but somehow you became aware of them. And once Radio 1 was around, you were much more aware of them. But we used to listen to Radio Luxembourg. We couldn't get Power Radio in Newcastle. But we used to listen to Radio Luxembourg. And they're just sort of amazing records, like I Can See for Miles or something, every Beatles record, you know. And that incredible competition. John Savage, I have a friend who does a thing called, I think it's called The Race. And he was trying to make a CD compilation of one record followed by the reaction to it. And that just goes on non-stop.
Oh, that's a lovely idea. So the record where you can actually hear
Right, if they're going to do that, we're going to do this.
Yeah.
So in 1967, how whimsical can you be? How heavy, 1968, how heavy can your guitar be?
Yeah.
In 1965, 6, what whimsical Victorian reference can you have? But also, how generally speaking, how weird can you be is what it is.
Mm.
And then weird becomes mainstream, so you've got to go weirder.
Yeah.
And that sort of, and then in that, you've sort of got that in the 70s with the Bowie thing and glam rock and everything, and then with punk. And then in the 80s, remember the Enemy used to call it new pop, which wasn't a bad description. And that was, there was a lot going on. Who could go to New York and record with Arthur Baker? Who could have the biggest drum sound played by one of Chic? There's a lot of musical ambition there.
Yeah.
And sometimes musical ambition is not what I don't hear now in the same way.
Mm. It's funny, I was just thinking about the 80s this morning, and I thought to myself, am I right in thinking the Human League put out a record called The Lebanon?
They did. It about 1982. It was a single.
And they still play it in their show.
Okay, fine. Yeah. And it wasn't. Sort of wasn't controversial.
Wasn't controversial. It was possibly regarded as slightly clunky.
Possibly.
But nonetheless, it was the Human League in their imperial phase.
Yeah.
So who were we?
And in their infinite wisdom. It's that idea that slight arrogance that pop stars, we have an opinion on something, you're going to want to hear it because we're the Human League. But musicians, you look back at that decade again, everyone was political. Most people were left-wing, actually. Even Spandau Ballet were left wing. You know,
Johnny Marr has some story about being on the Red Wedge tour, and there's Gary Kemp. And Johnny Marr can't really speak to Gary. They're across a vast chasm of taste and indiness, and you've totally sold out.
And just diversity.
But actually, of course, they get on very well because actually, in many ways, they're slightly similar people. And there they are both on the Red Wedge tour because no one, apart from Gary Newman, liked Mrs. Thatcher.
No, yeah, Gary Newman was the only one, wasn't he?
He was the only one. and of course, everyone got disenchanted with Red Wedge. But
go back to you joined Smash Hits. What was the first thing you did then? Can you remember?
We started putting together the yearbook. I think the first thing I did was, you sent me to Stockholm.
I did.
Actually, it's before. This is actually still Lightfoot Books. I think the first piece I wrote for Smash Hits was you sent me to Stockholm to interview Squeeze, by whom I knew you were a big fan of. I knew literally nothing. So I got all the albums sent over and I dutifully listened to them. And Eric Watson did the photographs.
Oh, really?
And we stayed in the Grand Hotel Stockholm, a very posh hotel, by the way, to this day. And we all went. The great thing about it was, wasn't Squeeze, much as we like them, is that we all went to ABBA's studio.
Yeah,
oh, wonderful.
Where Phil Collins.
Yeah. Was producing,
Frida.
Yeah. That's right, yeah, he was.
We didn't meet Frida, but we met Phil Collins. He showed us the studio, it was very nice. He showed, you know, well, basically showed Squeeze around, actually, and it was right. Me and Eric trailing behind them. And also someone from the NME.
And you interviewed, so I can remember you interviewing Culture Club and Duran Duran and.
The beginning, though, was very nerve wracking.
And
very, very
I just wondered if you ever met those people later on there, but they must have commented.
Even now, to be honest.
So, what do they say? Now.
I remember meeting Paul Weller at an airport. We were probably all doing the San Remo Song Festival in 1986.
Yeah.
That's where we met. I remember meeting Morrissey there, you know, in the airport. And could be early 87, actually. And Paul Weller was sort of amazed that West End Girls had been number one in America. Because he'd obviously been told by his record company that his kind of music wouldn't sell in America because it was too English. Mm-hmm. And the reality is, West End Girl was pretty English. And he was almost baffled, I could tell, by the fact we'd done this and he hadn't been able to do it. I remember Morrissey coming over with a sort of slightly bobbed chat with Morrissey. And Gary Kemp, the Spandau were on the fly, and we were all going... That was 87. Yeah, we were all going to the Brits Awards that night or the following night because we got an award and they were performing to the Barricades. People sort of got over it, but they would still refer to it. But the person who I hadn't seen in between interviewing him for Smash Hits in 1984 for about 35 years was John Taylor.
Who
I hadn't seen. Right. Actually, we met John Taylor at the San Remo Song Festival as well. And but then we all went to I went to the David Hockney exhibition before lockdown, so must be 2019, at the Tate Britain. And there's Nick Rhodes, who I quite often bump into, with John Taylor.
Fantastic!
It's one of those guys. We just carried on, you know, from 35 years previously.
Even Mark and I have this bizarre thing with people, and I think it's a unique Smash Hits thing. With people like Gary Kemp or whatever, Claire Grogan, or, you know, all those people, you might not have seen them for 25 years, but they go, hello!
They do.
Immediately. It's as if you've never left that Smash Hits universe. Still exists 40
but
years later.
But also, they loved that
Smash all those people
universe.
Are still.
Everyone was so affectionate.
Still
about
performing,
it.
Yeah. Still on telly.
You know, it was a good vibe. It was a totally good vibe, Smash
It
Hits.
Really was.
We didn't. Stitch people.
No,
up.
No, exactly.
The NME, to the very end of its print career,
yeah.
You'd be suspicious that they were going to stitch you up.
Well, I was going to ask you about that because you then suddenly became, you know, a musician. You were on the other side of the microphone being interviewed, and people were a little bit suspicious of you because you were an ex-journalist, weren't they?
This day, people ask me, "Oh, so I think you were a journalist? So you learned how to write the perfect pop song?" Which, and I always get the same answer. I said, "Well, you're a journalist. Have you learned that?"
Yeah.
I said, "Because what you learn about being a journalist is the press side of things.
Yeah.
So I can maybe see where your line of questioning is going, but." With the music side, it's you were an observer as a journalist, and now you're sort of making the records and doing it, and it hasn't anything to do with it really. The press thing is just a small part of it.
You're so good at interviews because you partly because you're just very witty and informative, but the idea that you also know what people are looking for, you know what they're trying to what they're going to pick up on, what they're going to make into a quote.
Yes. Although to be honest, Chris is pretty good at that too.
Yeah.
I mean, Chris is very good at also giving the gag in the interview.
Yeah.
Because I give the serious answer.
You give the long answer, he gives the short one.
And then he's
the
funny short one.
He does a little
I did an interview for my lyrics book with The Guardian, and it was in our studio. And right at the end, and Chris just hijacked the whole interview. So it was right at the end, he came in and said, "Have you seen the bins outside? They've moved the bins, there's rubbish everywhere. You'll have to call a council." And of course,
that's the headline.
All I immediately thought, well, if it was me, that's what it's all going to be about. and of course, it takes up you know, half of the last column anyway. And then I get a text message from Adam Clayton of U2 saying, did you sort out the bin?
That's very Stella, you know, that's very kind of, yes, what do you call it, Stella Street or whatever. It's like that kind of sort of fantasy world that you probably wrote about in the Smash It's yearbook. We obviously used to do that with the Smash It's yearbook, didn't we? Treated everybody as a fantasy figure. And here they all are in school, or a college, or a department store, or whatever, turning them into...
That was the great thing about the San Remo Pop Festival, music festival it was called, because you did get tons of people together backstage.
Yeah.
And actually people were normally quite... It was sort of a bit of a scene, it was quite... There was also a show in Germany called Peter's Pop Show, where it would be the same thing. And a load of German pop stars no one heard of, apart from Nina maybe. And again, you'd all be backstage, and the whole thing took forever, and you'd be chatting. It was sort of, but it was a bit like the fantasy made real.
Yeah. Don't you miss that now?
Yes, I do.
I mean, I really do, because you know you've got no idea of what a lot of pop musicians are like. You've got no kind of three-dimensional sort of understanding of who they are, whereas those like Smash Hits invented these kind of cartoon characters that they could then occupy.
Well, of course, you know, obviously nowadays everyone's on Instagram, but that's, of course, their own editorial, and it's probably...
Well, it is, but you had your own editorial in a sense with those fantastic books that Chris Heath wrote about you, which were kind of based on Michael Brown's
code. They were completely based on Love Me Do.
And they were so good because you had control of them, but they just told you so much about
them. We negotiated every sentence of those books with Chris Heath because he's a very stubborn person.
Oh, really?
And okay, you can cut that out, but you can keep your... Well, if you cut that out, you can keep that in.
You can lose one fuck.
You can keep out the...
Yes.
You can keep out the bit... There's no swear words in whatsoever.
Yeah.
You can keep out the bit where we slag off you two. But because we do, you know, things like that. But I don't know. I like that kind of reportage, and there's almost. I can't really believe is, because you're on YouTube, I can't believe there's not an audience for it somewhere. That's why I don't get.
I think
why that fell off a cliff.
Well, there is, but everybody became completely paranoid about their loss of control, didn't they? You know,
they
stopped reading.
The 80s pop stars were the most controlling in all pop. The Human League.
Yes,
they were.
Used to come in the office.
Oh, they used to come in the office and stand over the light box looking at pictures saying, you can't use that, you can't use that.
Well, I mean, Chris and I would do something pretty similar, actually. But because people wanted... George Michael, actually, was probably the number one. Because he was so obsessed with his image. Because I always thought George Michael looked in the mirror.
George Michael only wanted to photograph from one side of his face. Well,
yeah, I think he looked in the mirror and
we
saw
had a picture of an appendix
the spotty
scar.
Greek schoolboy.
Yeah, and never,
and that's not sure what he wants. That, not
yeah,
what the
yeah.
image is meant to be.
Yeah.
And so that sort of that controlling thing went in a blur. Worked like that in the '90s. I don't think it's. So I don't think it is because of control that it went. I mean, maybe people just lost interest in reading about it. I don't know. But I would.
Yeah, but if your enemy had not come in 1974...
It was a catastrophe.
There was nothing.
They did go on strike, in fact. Yeah.
A lot of times.
Yeah.
There was a complete pop news blackout for the period that they were gone. Doesn't apply anymore.
No.
And so if there was a printed source, it's just one source alongside it.
At the time, in Dave Rimmer's Like Punk Never Happened book, he records the shift from the Weekly Music Press to tabloids and Smash Hits, and then Smash Hits lookalikes. That was definitely a thing. We could look over Carnaby Street into the NME offices and think, you are going down the dumpster. and we have just sold 600,000 copies of our latest issue. You can only dream about that.
And so ends part one. Part two will feature Neil talking about pop's obsession with identity, why Bronski Beat was so significant, life in London when you had dyed red Bowie hair and wore women's shoes, appearing on Soul Train, meeting ABBA, Steven Spielberg and Joni Mitchell, and David Bowie's scathing one-word reviews of Michael Jackson and Oasis at the Brits. All in part two. See you there.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.